FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get three free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.
This episode of the Financial Survival Network is brought to you by Auren Resources. Auren is a junior exploration company with the appetite of a major, focused on finding the next globally significant discovery to create enormous potential upside for shareholders. It is one of the most aggressive exploration companies pursuing scalable gold and copper deposits and has a premier 7-project portfolio, including its 2 flagships, Committee Bay in the Arctic and Sombrero in Peru. With Auren's unparalleled technical team and highly experienced management with a history of success in advancing and monetizing exploration assets, Auren has been called one of the best in the junior exploration sector. Auren trades on the TSX and the NYSE under AUG. To learn more, go to aurenresources.com. That's A-U-R-Y-N resources.com.
FSN Radio. It's all about what's next.
Welcome. You are listening to the Financial Survival Network. I'm Kerry Lutz. It is 2/7/19. We've got January behind us, but I just thought this would be a great time to get a couple of experts together to go over where we are, where we've been, and where we're going. And that pertains to the economy, to our mental states, to the collective psyche of our society, of our culture. And we'll be talking about the latest Fed actions, behavior of the metals markets recently, and changing from the fourth quarter of 2018 to present. We'll discuss the broader economy, whether it's really expanding or contracting. And we'll cover a little bit belatedly some predictions for 2019. And guests on the show today, our good friend John Rubino from dollarcollapse.com, and our good friend Craig Hemke, a.k.a. Turd Ferguson, got to get that in, Craig, from tfmetalsreport.com. Craig, John, welcome to the show.
Hey, Kerry. Hey, Craig.
Hey, this is going to be fun. Thank you for the invitation, Kerry.
Hey, it's a pleasure as always. So let's get right into it. Federal Reserve, since everything meaningful in the world revolves around the Fed and the wisdom of the Fed governors, and particularly the chairman of the Fed, which is Mr. Powell. John, what is your take on what they're really up to now? Are they going to keep raising, or are they going to stop and wait and see, kind of take that watchful waiting view? Like that's actually an option when you've got prostate cancer. You could get it taken out, you could get chemo, you could get radiation, or what they have called watchful waiting. What do you think is going on here, John?
Well, we always knew they were going to cave when the markets started, you know, punishing the Fed for raising rates or tightening via their balance sheet or whatever. And they did it quickly, you know, more quickly than I think a lot of people expected, even the cynics who thought the Fed was clearly dancing to the market's tune. Maybe we're a little surprised at how quickly it happened. In October and November, the stock market started to flake out because interest rates were up. And the Fed basically caved at that point. They said, okay, you know, those 4 interest rate hikes we were going to do in 2019, never mind about that. And you know how we were going to let our balance sheet contract by letting bonds run off when they matured? Never mind about that either. We'll freeze the balance sheet, we'll freeze interest rates. And Janet Yellen even came out this morning and said she thinks the next Fed move is a cut in rates. So 2019 could be the year in which, after, you know, a little tiny tightening, we start to see the Fed go back to extremely easy money, cutting rates, increasing asset purchases, and doing some other exotic stuff that they hadn't done in the past, like overtly buying equities, for instance. That's probably next on the list. And then who knows after that, maybe even real estate. But the experimentation is about to begin again.
All right, Craig, just jump right in. Give us your views.
Yeah, I just to add on to what John had mentioned, I think he's spot on. You know, the Fed has clearly seen now that the market, the stock market, can't tolerate the 10-year note any higher than 3.25%. We got up there twice last fall and then proceeded to just plunge. And this is important because of the underfunded pensions, both public and private. The 401k balances, you know, half the American people don't even have $5,000 in savings. I mean, another 50% market correction, you know, I mean, it's just not something that the Fed, the economy, the banks, that anybody can stomach. And so we're clearly headed that direction. I don't think there's ever been an instance in the past where during a rate hike cycle that the Fed has paused and then started hiking again. Every other previous instance, they have paused and then begun cutting. So take that under advisement as well. Then finally, as we sit here and speak, the 2-year note is yielding less than 2.5%, and the 10-year note is under 270. Well, the current Fed funds peg is 2.25 to 2.5. And so when it gets quoted, people say 240. They put on another 25 basis points in March. They're talking 2.5 to 275 or 260. They're basically by if they do that, they will be inverting the yield curve from overnight out to 10 years. They're not going to do that. I mean, there's a lot of pundits out there, you know, and they waste a lot of time and space because they got to have something to talk about, you know, proselytizing and profitizing whether the Fed will hike again in March. Yeah, maybe they will, maybe they won't. But I can tell you, if they don't get the 2-year note back up to, you know, 280 or something, and the 10-year note back over 3, they're not doing jack, period. So I say everybody listen to us on it. Just keep an eye on the bond market. That'll tell you if the Fed has any chance of hiking in March or not.
So, Craig, you made a crucial point there, which is the system is so over leveraged right now that we can't handle an equities bear market. And we definitely can't handle a recession. In other words, we can't get through it the way we normally get through these things because there's so much bad debt out there that can blow up as soon as the money flow tap is turned off, that we would see a cascade failure of the leveraged speculating community out there, which is almost everybody these days. Yeah. And the guys in charge of the Fed and the Treasury Department, they know this to a certain extent. They know that they can't allow a downturn in either equity prices or the broader economy to happen because there's no coming out of it once it gets started. So they have to do whatever it takes to basically they have a mission impossible right now. They have to keep the economy from ever turning down again. And what it's going to take this time around is going to be extraordinary.
Yeah.
Hey, so that question, we're asking them, they're being charged with a mission that they can't possibly accomplish, because as far as I know, the New York Times might have said God was dead, but the New York Times did not say the business cycle had disappeared and was presumed dead. So, Craig, what do you do? They have to fail. They're being set up for failure, aren't they?
Well, in the end, it's not surprising. You know, when I started my site back in 2010, we always have had the tagline, the end of the great Keynesian experiment is upon us. And that's where we are. I mean, at the end of the Keynesian experiment, of the debt experiment, things just get untenable. You know, the interest rates and the money supply and everything that has to grow so quickly to try to service all of the existing debt that's already been built up, eventually it just spirals out of control. And that's, we're in those kind of final stages. What I think is interesting, though, then, is to compare where we are now to where we were, say, 10 years ago, coming out of the great financial crisis or whatever you might want to call it. And I think that's what, again, it's that comparison that the gold market, and I guess we'll say the silver market too, is beginning to sense. You know, a lot of folks are trying to, even right now in the beginning of 2019, trying to say, well, the only reason gold rallied in the fourth quarter because the stock market was going down. And, you know, there was a safe haven bid. I don't know, maybe a tiny bit of that. But ever since the stock market recovered after Christmas with the help of the president's working group on financial markets, I mean, the stock market's back up 14% and gold's continued to go higher.
Yeah.
So I would say that the gold is actually instead sensing, you know, people are coming to terms with this idea that, whoa, wait a second, hold on just a minute. All this babble about balance sheet and interest rate normalization is just exactly that, just babble. And that this is never going to end. Even one of those people on CNBC back on FOMC day, back at the end of January, actually had a moment of clarity and truth. You know, this lady was like a mutual fund manager. She said, we got to remember that this is all just one big monetary experiment for the last 10 years, and it continues.
And that's a great point.
That's true. And so I think all of that is beginning. That reality is setting in, and that's going to be a big driver, particularly precious metals going forward.
Hey, and you kind of jumped the gun a little bit, but that's fine. We're not like tied into to heavy formal agendas here. But John, so behavior of metals. Now, I'll tell you, I watch it probably not as closely or as knowledgeably as Craig, but when I see things like last night, so we probably, since we're talking about metals, I guess it would probably be a good time to mention what they're trading for. Right now, gold is right at 1310 and a half. Silver, it's up $4 for the day. Silver is up 3 cents, 1567. So we see a pattern starting here that hasn't occurred in quite some time, and that is you will see losses in the access market, in the late night market. Gold's down $4 or $5 an ounce. And then I wake up this morning and it's up $4. So we see an upside reversal from the offshore markets. Haven't seen that probably in 8 years on a regular basis. This is happening 2, 3, 4 times a week. What are you gleaning from this, John?
Well, one of two things is true about precious metals. And the first thing is that they were already set up for a nice run towards the end of last year, because the commitment of traders report, where the speculators were extremely bearish, that's usually a bullish thing. And then seasonality, you know, January is usually a great time for precious metals because that's when the Asians do all their gold and silver buying in anticipation of giving jewelry for spring wedding presents. So normally, this is a great time for precious metals, one of the best times of the year. So the question is that all it is? You know, is it just another January effect, you know, another spring Asian buying season pushing precious metals up? Or are we finally at that inflection point where we recognize that the Fed is done tightening and from now on it's easy money to the end of time or to the end of the Keynesian fractional reserve banking, fiat currency financial system. So this is a very big deal for precious metals. And we'll kind of sort of know that by what they do later in the year. You know, if we hit the sell in May and go away seasonal period and precious metals go back down, then okay, this was just a normal part of the annual cycle for precious metals. But if they keep going up, even if, you know, stocks are falling and corporate profits are falling, which we need to talk about in a minute, corporate profits. But if precious metals go up in the face of that, then maybe this is it. Maybe this is the big run. Because we had a huge run in the 1970s, very early 80s, and then another big run in the 2000s. And this third leg was always going to be the big one. It was going to be the resolution of the gigantic financial mistake that began after World War II. And if this is the start of it, then we need to be ready. But you can't know that ahead of time. You know, it could be either of these things very, very possibly. But I think it's definitely something we want to watch now because we've created the conditions for a global financial crisis on an epic scale and an epic run in gold and silver prices. And if this is the time, if this is the beginning of it, then we absolutely want to be positioned for it by owning bullion stored well and wisely, and gold and silver mining stocks, at least the highest quality versions of those things. So I have no idea whether this is it, but it is coming, and this might be it.
And Craig, what do you think? You're more trader oriented. I know you have watched the dollar yen rate and the yuan dollar rate for tracking gold. But now we see different behavior in the market. It's way different. It's an accumulative pattern, if you will, rather than a distributive pattern, to borrow from stocks. What observations can you share with us about how precious metals, particularly gold, because silver is the laggard here, it's neutral at best, but gold has really been behaving differently in its trading patterns. You've noticed it, right?
Yeah. And you know, what's funny is drawing upon my personal experience. Yeah. You can see what you mentioned, Kerry, in that this is different. We're entering a different period. We're actually in a bull market, and it has been so long. Right. I mean, it, what, 2013 when we got smashed down through 15, 25 that had been the floor coming out of 2011. So, I mean, it's 6 years ago. And I think a lot of folks have completely forgotten, you know, what a bull market in the precious metals looks like, much less how to trade it. And so going forward, I think you will get back to what we saw in, let's call it 2003 through 2011. And maybe kind of what we saw a little bit in 2016, which was kind of like a something in between. You've got to recognize how the markets operate, how the metals are priced through, you know, these derivatives that have nothing to do with physical trading. And you got to understand which parties control the derivatives. And then you got to, you know, kind of manage your own emotions from there and understand that there are going to be times when things look fantastic. And you think, oh, man, here we go. Well, that typically the time you got to sell some if you're trading. And then there are going to be times when things look, oh, God, there, you know, now we're going straight back down. That's typically when you got to buy some. It'll never move up straight. And it'll never, you know, it'll never be a nonstop rally. It's always going to move three steps forward and two steps back just because of the way the derivative markets are set up. But it's a, like you said, Kerry, it's going to be a challenge now for mentally for people who haven't experienced a bull market in the precious metals, or at least have forgotten what it's like to be in tune and aware of what's going on. And one other thing I'd add, and I've tried to include this in every single interview and appearance I've had since late last year, people need to think now about what they're going to do and what their plan is when, say, silver gets back to 25. Because a lot of folks are out there thinking, I bought silver in 2011 and 2012, and my cost basis is 30, and I've never bought a single ounce since. And man, if that stuff ever gets back to even, I'm blowing that stuff out. Okay, fine, knock yourself out if that's what you want to do. But ask yourself two questions. Do you realize that you're converting it back into dollars? If you do so, okay, so what are you going to do with those dollars at that point? And second, are you prepared, you know, to where if things get out of hand now going forward, that you don't own any silver if you sell it all, you know, and now you're going to be stuck chasing, trying to buy it back. So people need to kind of mentally prepare for, again, a change in sentiment, a change in market structure, remembering what it used to be like 6-7 years ago, but also how to handle your emotions as prices accelerate and move forward, and to make sure you're thinking clearly as it does in terms of, you know, what are you going to do with the physical that you already have?
Yeah, those are all great points. And it's a big paradigm shift. That's what I guess is what's happening here. I refer to it, the last 10 years was the new economy. I think we're now entering the new economy. And I don't know about you guys, but I have no idea what it's going to look like, but let's talk about what our current economy looks like. John, you mentioned corporate profits, where they're heading. I guess that always comes in along with stock buybacks, which seem to be decidedly down at the present time.
Hey, Kerry, one more thing about precious metals before we go on to corporate profits. One of the big sea changes that we've seen lately is central banks going from net sellers to net buyers. All of a sudden, besides just China and Russia, there are a lot of central banks who've decided to start adding gold to their reserves. And that is a big new piece of buying pressure that is, you know, functionally possibly unlimited, because central banks have as much money as they want to spend on whatever they want. And if they decide as a group that gold is now an asset class they have to diversify back into, that's a very big deal. And that will give a lot of fuel to the next leg of the gold bull market. And again, we're seeing that now. So this could be a big change. Now, corporate profits. One of the things driving the stock market over the past few years has been the fact that the governments of the world pushed interest rates down to a point where it's actually profitable for companies to buy back their own stock. In other words, they borrow some money at, say, 1%, buy back their stock, which has a dividend yield of 2%, and make the difference. It's a cash flow positive activity. So corporations across the spectrum in the U.S. have been doing this on a record scale the past few years. And as a result, the amount of triple B rated debt in the U.S. corporate sector is now at a record level. It's just massive compared to what it was even 10 years ago. And that is one step above junk. So in the next recession, well, it has two effects. One is that in the next recession, a lot of these companies are going to be downgraded. So that's going to be one of the really crisis-y kinds of things that we see. All these companies being downgraded to junk, and then funds that aren't allowed to hold junk having to sell their bonds. It's going to cause turmoil in the fixed income market. And it also lowers the forward profitability of these companies because they're at a point now where they can't borrow any more money to buy back their stock and push up earnings per share artificially. So their earnings, as reported, earnings per share are going to be flat to negative going forward, where in the past they were rising at double-digit rates in some cases. And their stock prices are currently at levels that still assume rising profits. So as that becomes clear to people, in other words, that corporate profits are not going to grow like they have been, and they might even start shrinking in the next few years, that's going to have a huge impact on the stock market. Because, you know, you just, if you're an optimistic investor, you don't own things with falling earnings. That's just not part of your mindset. So you'll see all the momentum players selling stocks like crazy in the next few years in this scenario. And there's our equities bear market, which the system can't handle. And so corporate profitability could be one of the big drivers of this change in market sentiment.
Interesting. What's your opinion on this, Craig? I mean, I've felt for a long time that a lot of these balance sheet tricks that companies are engaging in, I mean, look at GE. GE is effectively insolvent, broke. They need to be split up and pieces need to be sold off. Is that a portent of things to come in the real economy?
Yeah. I mean, first of all, I think John described it beautifully. And I think that's all stuff people, especially if you're in equities, and probably everybody listening to us has some exposure through their 401k or IRA or something. And I think that's all very wise to consider everything that John just said. I would just add, you know, from a uncertainty standpoint, that's going to impact corporate confidence, business confidence going forward too. And then what do I mean by uncertainty? When Trump was elected, I mean, we went from this kind of stagnant, you know, less than 2% alleged growth economy to all of a sudden, you know, I guess, you know, by traditional measures, things were going along pretty well. And I think that's because Trump provided some certainty. He was going to cut corporate taxes, as an example. And CEOs were able to look at that and say, okay, all right, if we know that tax cuts are, you know, coming, and, you know, this is just one example, then that allows us to kind of plan forward about how many workers we might be able to hire, how we might be able to expand our business, you know, that kind of thing. But here we are in 2019. I think there's a lot of uncertainty where there used to be certainty, especially on the political end. You know, given that Trump's agenda now, whatever it was, is now probably completely stalled. I mean, the acrimony is so high in Washington that I just don't see the Democrats that control the House giving Trump any victories from here to run on next year. And that, besides everything else that gets discussed back there about, you know, uncertainty, of, you know, whether impeachment, you know, all that kind of stuff, I think that begins to trickle down and affects business confidence, which, again, affects consumer confidence as well. And that, again, that begins to impact how businesses act, their hiring practices, you know, where they think things are going forward. The whole thing begins to feed on itself with lower equity prices, as John described, and, you know, worsening economic data, which then, as we mentioned earlier, gives the Fed no wiggle room at all and starts leading to a reversal of this policy and the awareness that, oh, wait a second, things, we're not going back to 4% of the 10-year, are we? There is no normalization. And the whole thing begins just to kind of spiral with its own momentum. And again, I think that's how those pieces fit together. And I think that's all part of where we're headed.
Interesting. Yeah, it's all interconnected. You can't just separate one piece of it. Look, the bellwether stock are certainly one of them. There's two bellwethers, Apple, maybe three, Apple, Google, and Amazon. So Apple, we already know they're not selling as many iPhones, and the only thing they can do is raise prices. I've always said buying Apple shares are like buying a futures contract on the iPhone, you know, because that's what the company is. That's all they do now. 80% of their activity is mobile devices, iPhone related. So, yeah, they've got their services, they got their store and all that. We got Amazon, which isn't the super most profitable company in the world, but for some reason, people keep buying this stuff. It's kind of like when you go to a restaurant. It's not really a good restaurant, but it's not really a bad restaurant. And the price is fair, and you just keep going there, even though you don't really like the place. And that's the way I see Amazon. Google is the real deal, but it seems like they have so many governmental risks coming up that privacy, et cetera, EU, so many issues. I don't know how, where they go in the future to keep the growth coming. My point is that the economy has kind of been an illusion state for quite some time based on expectations. How realistic is it, John, that we're going to see any kind of meaningful growth other than what the government statistics mills generate?
Well, people who don't understand economics think that the business cycle and the recessions that happen every once in a while are the result of policy mistakes. They think the government is in charge of it. But what the business cycle really is an expression of human nature over time. And that's why they all pretty much look the same. You know, all the business cycles follow the same path because the human mind is finite. It does the same thing over and over again. And the big aspect of this is that we're emotional. If something goes a certain way for a long enough time, we all start to assume that that's normal and will go on forever. And we act accordingly. So when an economy is growing, people, after a few years, forget that it can be any other way, and they start acting with their money in ways that assume steady growth forever. In other words, they borrow a lot of money to invest in things that will go up if the economy keeps growing. And as that debt builds up, that becomes the limiting factor in economic growth. You can't continue to grow after debt reaches a certain level because that debt inhibits you. You've got to pay interest on it. You can't borrow more money at a certain point because nobody will lend it to you. And then the economy turns back down and wipes out the bad portion of that debt and starts over. We're at that point now. You know, we're at the point after a 10-year expansion when the amount of debt in the system and the amount of bad debt, importantly, is at record levels. So we can't continue to grow if the marginal productivity of debt, in other words, how much growth you get from a given dollar of new borrowing, is near zero. It used to be that, say, in the 1960s or 70s, if you borrowed a dollar and invested it, you got a new dollar of GDP for that. Now, you have to borrow $6, $7, $8 to get a new dollar of GDP. So we're reaching the point where the current system just can't do it anymore. We're so over indebted, we're so financially fragile that the business cycle has to turn down. Maybe it's not this year, maybe it is this year. There's no way to know exactly when it happens, but we're seeing signs of that out there where, you know, corporate profits are flatlining and real estate isn't going up the way it used to and stock prices are starting to get choppy and all of that stuff is normal topping behavior for a business cycle, which means that we might be there, we might not be there, but we're getting closer all the time. And there's no way that this expansion continues. Like the Congressional Budget Office is predicting no recession for the next 10 years in its budget projections. That's crazy. You know, maybe not this year. Maybe it continues for another year, but then it breaks down almost guaranteed just because we can't keep on leveraging ourselves this way. There's just no mathematical possibility of that happening. So, yeah, I think the business cycle is going to assert itself here pretty soon. There's nothing the monetary authorities can do about it, but you know they'll try. And I think that's the interesting part of the story. The crazy stuff they will do to try to stop this next recession from turning into a Great Depression.
And so we've gotten into predictions for 2019. Obviously, the monetary authorities are going to be fighting like the Dickens to stave off the inevitable. What other, just give us two other trends or things that you see coming to prominence in 2019, John?
Well, politics is going to get even crazier.
Obviously. Oh, my God. Are you sure?
Yeah. If it didn't, that would be the big surprise. I mean, all the rest of this stuff is kind of speculative about at least the timing. But crazy politics in the U.S. is a lock. That is so guaranteed that I can't imagine us having placid go along and get along kind of politics in the year ahead. Basically, what we've done with Donald Trump is unleash the subconscious of the Republicans. They now feel free to say anything they want to. And the Democrats, for a little while, were inhibited, and it drove them crazy because they wanted to be able to say, they wanted to be able to speak their quote unquote truth the way the Republicans were getting to. And so now that's happening. The newest crop of Democrat politicians are full on socialists in a lot of cases. You know, that used to be a word you could not use. You couldn't say the S word if you were a Democrat politician because it was so out of favor. It was so unpopular. It ended your career in most, for instance, congressional districts. Now it's cool. You can say you're a socialist and you can propose any crazy socialist thing that has failed dozens of times in the past. You know, massively high marginal tax rates, free everything for everybody, and we'll worry about paying for it later. You know, that's now the mainstream of the Democrat Party. So, and the Democrats control Congress, which is the branch of the government that's allowed to investigate the president. So you put all that together, and remember that Trump is going to continue to be Trump, which means he's going to say anything he feels like, and a lot of it's going to be at 4 o'clock in the morning via Twitter. And so it's just going to be crazy this year, very chaotic. And there's a feedback loop always between finance and politics. So what we're going to do is turbocharge that feedback loop in a negative way, where politics is so crazy that it scares the financial markets. And then the financial markets react and behave in crazy ways, which spooks people, which makes politics even crazier. And it's not clear where the end of this process is, but we're going to see it rev up this year, almost certainly.
I have no doubt you're correct. Craig, couple of predictions or observations for the coming year?
Well, to what John was just saying, I mean, I've written a lot in the last couple of months comparing what I think 2019 is going to be like to 2010. And I can double back to that in a second, but a part of that thesis is 2011 as well. And as John just described, the political chaos, it's a mirror image in that the situation 11 versus 19 reflect each other, only it's now a Republican president that the Democrats can't wait to kick out of office, just as in 2011 it was a Democrat president in his first term the Republicans couldn't wait to kick out of office. And so you got this craziness and gridlock and all that stuff in 2011. It all culminated in August of 2011 with debt ceiling debates and government shutdowns, and it was at that time that the S&P ratings agency cut U.S. debt to AA+, first time it had never been AAA rated, remains there to this day, actually.
Yeah, correct.
And so all of you can begin to see how, again, it's a opposite, but it's the same thing, right? It's the same situation that we're heading into from a timing perspective and a political perspective and all that. And just remember what was happening with gold. Gold at that time was considered to be the only safe haven with the Swiss franc. And then on September 6th of 2011, the Swiss National Bank decided that they announced that they'd pegged to the euro, leaving only gold as a safe haven. And 30 minutes before they announced that, gold was hit for $50, and down she went from there. That's probably a topic for another day, but that's, again, August in that summer of 2011, 1 year before the election, was when all that came to a head. August and the summer of 2019 is exact same thing. Backing up then to a prediction, and like I said, what I keep writing about, we've spoken during this call a lot about you know, the economy kind of rolling over and confidence failing and the stock market and the Fed having to you know, keep using the paddles and everything that they can. Powell just said last week that, you know, in response to a question in his press conference about what can you do next time, it was a typical every tool in the toolbox is available, and our balance sheet has room to grow substantially, he said, which just tells you right there that, I mean, they're ready for QE4 when they need to. And again, you compare this back to 2010, when all of the talk on every news channel was of green shoots. Yeah. The economy rising from the rubble of the financial crisis. And in fact, by the second quarter of 2010, we had 3.2% GDP growth. And there was, QE1 was a one-off. It was never going to happen again and all this kind of stuff. But then the economy began to slow and the stock market began to waver. And in November of 2010, here comes QE2. And the gold ended up 2010 up almost 30% from about 1050 to 1450. And I think we all recall that though silver went sideways at around $16 for the first half of 2010, it proceeded to go from 16 to 48 in 8 months as the world realized, wait a second, hold on. I thought QE was a one-off and everything was back to normal. Okay, well, then here we are again in 2019. It's not necessarily exactly the same, but it's a mirror image. The economy's slowing. The Fed can't allow it. And they're talking about all these tricks again. And as that sets in, you end up with a year that looks a lot like 2010. I don't know if gold's going to be up 30% this year, but it's probably going to have the best year that it's had since 2010. And then, oh boy, where do we go next year? So should be a very interesting time. And as I said earlier, this is the time for people to kind of readjust their expectations and their, how they're going to respond emotionally and financially to all of this. And now's the time to really start thinking about it so that you can protect yourself as best you can and even profit the best you can.
Great point. The one thing that takeaway I get from this is that 2019 is not going to be like 2018. Although 2018 was a lot of volatility, stock market taking a huge hit for the first time in many years, 20% hit. That qualifies as a genuine correction. And the general consensus was, it was the beginning of a bear market. We're still waiting for the confirmation there. We're waiting for the market to go back to, I guess it was its October lows, to break them. That'll be confirmation. For right now, we're kind of muddling through. And I guess that's what's going to continue to happen until the big changes really kick in. Guys, I really appreciate you coming on, helping all of you out there to try to get a grasp on what's happening and what you need to do to really cover yourself, to really hedge your bets, and to really protect your wealth for the coming year and the coming years ahead. For John Rubino, you find him at dollarcollapse.com. And for Craig Hemke, it's over at tfmetalsreport.com. Guys, thank you so much.
Thanks, Gary.
Gary, you said it. Financial Survival Network. It's what it's all about.
FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get 3 free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.